In 1796, a young scion of a family of Virginia landowners, a cousin of Thomas Jefferson, passionately denounced slavery in his will and called for his own slaves to be freed and given land to start a new life. It took a decade and a half before his dream took root on a ridge near the confluence of two rivers in Prince Edward County in Southern Virginia. The freed blacks called their new community Israel Hill. Melvin Patrick Ely, a professor at the College of William and Mary, has written a detailed account of that experiment in freedom and the role it played in the larger national debate about slavery. His new book is Israel on the Appomattox, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
So tell us about this landowner, Richard Randolph.
Richard Randolph, as you say, was a young cousin of Jefferson. Like Jefferson, he believed that slavery was immoral, but he differed from Thomas Jefferson in that he, Richard Randolph, believed that the races were equally endowed. Jefferson suspected that whites were superior to blacks. Jefferson and many others who denounced slavery thought that if slaves were to be emancipated, they'd have to be moved out of the United States, could never live in peace with whites as free people. Richard Randolph set up an experiment that essentially was going to prove the opposite. He established or called for the establishment of a community of his ex-slaves in the very neighborhood where they had toiled in bondage, surrounded by plantations that were still worked by their fellow slaves. So far from being expatriated, these ex-slaves were going to build a life in freedom in their own homeland, their homeland being Prince Edward County, Virginia.
And Richard Randolph was unusual in envisioning that his freed slaves would flourish in the society where they had been born?
The idea that you should give these ex-slaves the wherewithal to build an independent life was very unusual. Most masters who manumitted slaves might have provided a little bit of startup support, but actually granting land that would belong to them and be theirs forever, not quite unique, but it's quite unusual.
You just used the word manumitted. Tell us exactly what that means.
To manumit a slave is to liberate that person as a private act. We usually speak of emancipation when we're talking of a whole population. But if a master decides to free one slave or six slaves or all of his or her slaves, that's a manumission.
Okay. Would you read us a bit of this will in which Richard Randolph declared his intention to free the slaves? I had in mind the part that ends with his apology.
I do hereby declare that it's my will and desire, nay, most anxious wish, that my Negroes, all of them, be liberated, and I do declare them by this writing, free and emancipated, to all intents and purposes whatsoever. I thus yield them up their liberty, basely wrested from them by my forefathers, and beg, humbly beg their forgiveness for the manifold injuries I have too often inhumanly, unjustly, and mercilessly inflicted on them.
At one point, I think you describe this as one of the most passionate indictments of slavery this side of Frederick Douglass.
Yes, this will is really an abolitionist tract, written not in the North but in the South, not in the 1840s but in the 1790s. Richard Randolph's main business was to denounce and renounce slavery as an institution.
And yet he did not free slaves while he was living. How impressed should we be with him?
Well, it's easy to be impressed by Randolph on the level of ideas, but as you say, he didn't free any slaves. Most of his slaves he inherited from his father. Richard only lived to be 26 years old. It was his wife to whom the dirty work of actually accomplishing this was left.
Yeah, tell us about Judith Randolph. She was a cousin of his, right? A cousin of her husband's, right?
Yeah, they were all each other's cousins pretty much. She, in the end, remains true to his ideals and sets these slaves free, but not before stalling and hemming and hawing, just because she was used to living the life of a great planter family. To divest herself of slaves was to remove herself from the only life that she had ever known or could easily consider herself living.
Well, it wasn't just divesting herself of the slaves. She also, according to her husband's will, was supposed to settle property upon them.
Yes. Richard called for 400 acres of his land to be parceled out among ex-slave families according to their merits, as he put it. She parceled it out among 9 black households, newly freed people whom she had just liberated. So she was divesting herself, as you say, not only of human property, but of some of her landed property as well.
At one point, you talk about the relationship between whites and blacks over the generations that you detail. But was there a difference in the way whites related to slaves compared to the way they related to free blacks?
Yes, there is a difference in that there's no way under slavery to practice Christian kindness in a thoroughgoing way. You just can't do it because people are property. They are bought and sold. Now, free blacks were second or third class citizens, but they had rights. They had the right to security and life and limb. They had the right to buy and sell property, including land and buildings, to bequeath it to their children. They had the right to engage in business. They had the right to file civil suits against white people. These are important rights that helped free blacks to hold their own in a system where they couldn't vote, they couldn't sit on a jury, they couldn't testify against a white person in a court of law, and they sometimes had to pay special taxes that white people didn't have to pay. So there's a balance between the deprivation of rights that free blacks suffered and the recognition by whites, on the other hand, that free blacks were free and deserved to be treated as free people, albeit second-class citizens.
You talk about the symbolic importance of Israel Hill as a community of freed blacks. How was that used by both sides in the larger national debate about abolition and slavery?
From the 1830s on, white people in the South who wanted to defend the institution of slavery against abolitionists and other critics were very concerned to depict slavery as a moral and just institution. People who defended slavery said that Africans and African Americans couldn't thrive, couldn't even survive unless they had the supervision and tutelage of whites, and therefore slavery was not only a necessary evil but a positive good. There was a very prominent white man in Prince Edward County who bought the plantation next to Israel Hill, in fact, named Colonel James Madison, not the former president, who published an article in 1836 claiming that the free black community of Israel Hill had degenerated, its residents had become thieves, idlers, and prostitutes. Now, I show in the book that none of that is true, that Israel Hill had, everybody on Israel Hill had held his or her own, and a number of them had prospered in a most impressive way. The myth of Israel Hill having failed became a symbol for pro-slavery people in the 1830s, and again, in a big way, as the Civil War approached, people who wanted to prove that slavery was the only proper condition for African American people.
And what happened to Israel Hill after the Civil War?
Well, Israel Hill, as a community of people who did a little bit of farming and did a lot of boating and crafts and so forth, continued to exist after the Civil War and, in fact, well into the 20th century. W.E.B. Du Bois, the famous social scientist and later civil rights leader, actually spent several months in 1897 in Farmville in Israel Hill, Virginia. And what he said is that a prosperous black middle class had emerged. What he saw, Du Bois saw happening, was that the younger generation were already moving out by moving to Baltimore and New York and Richmond or to the coal fields of West Virginia looking for better work. It's part of the great black migration that is a hallmark of the 20th century.
What exists at Israel Hill today?
Today, there are half a dozen or so well-kept residences of African-American people. There's no farming going on Israel Hill today. The importance of farming was really diminishing already before the Civil War. So what once would have been tilled fields, are now pretty much covered with woods. So if you go there today, you will see a small neighborhood that hardly even hints at what would have been there 100 or 150 years ago.
Melvin Patrick Ely's book is Israel on the Appomattox, a Southern Experiment in Black Freedom from the 1790s through the Civil War, published by Knopf. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.